Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. A few years ago, I stumbled across a remarkable book called Hexen 2039, which was put out by our guest today, the artist, British artist, Suzanne Treister. And immediately I was sort of brought into a world that was very familiar and yet very odd and fresh and unusual. It contained images of Jack Parsons, the rocket scientist from Southern California, who was, of course, bound up with Crowley, Aleister Crowley magic, and there were images of The Wizard of Oz and Bewitched and Gershom Scholem's books, and it seemed at first a bit random, a sort of scattershot selection of the odd undercurrents of the 20th century, but then it began to cohere in these strange sort of suggestion that was at once artsy and also very research-heavy, very cognitive, very intellectual in an esoteric sense. And what Hexen 2039 was one collection of materials from the Rosalind Brodsky Project, Rosalind Brodsky being a sort of pseudonym or alternative personality of Suzanne Treister, who is a time traveler doing research on the hidden underbellies of power and mysticism, occultism, and mind control that in some ways constitute our world, and increasingly so. In fact, the sorts of strange undercurrents of conspiracy culture, the occult, mind control, psychedelics, media manipulation, et cetera, are all much closer to the surface these days, making Suzanne's work particularly rich and ripe. And last year she came out with an even more remarkable book, Hexen 2.0, which targeted even more specifically an aspect of 20th century history that I find particularly fascinating and troublingly relevant, which is the history of cybernetics and the sort of post-war explosion of thinking about technology as a control and communication system, understanding what connects human beings to machines and animals and how learning can work through machines. And these ideas spread very widely, and they went very weird places, including into the counterculture and psychedelic culture and new media culture, and indeed they're kind of part of the digital waters we swim, i.e. drown in, these days. And again, Suzanne's work, which is also very richly available online, so if you haven't heard from her, I encourage you to immediately just pop onto the web, and you can go to SuzanneTreister.net, and you can have access to a lot of these images. She approaches this from an art angle, so in a way, she doesn't have to make all the final connections that you would make if you're reading some kind of conspiracy theory or some kind of academic study of the history of post-war power. There's a kind of openness and a sort of suggestion, and in a way, it's even more true to the facts. So it's really a remarkable body of work, and I think what epitomizes her approach, both as an artist, an even somewhat cheeky artist, and as a researcher into these hidden streams of 20th century history, is the Hexen 2.0 Tarot Deck, which is a full tarot deck, beautifully drawn, marvelous colors, in which this very history is exploited for oracular system. So the fool is Aldous Huxley, the magician is Timothy Leary, the Queen of Swords is a drones card, Nikola Tesla is the King of Wands, and it's a remarkable way of approaching the occult. And we talk about the occult and magic a fair amount on this show, but we don't really do it so much as occultists or magicians. It's a little bit more the way I think Suzanne is doing it, which is that to try to grapple with the situation we're in now, this insane world, technology, media, transformation, mutation, the sort of mixture of sort of science fiction fascination with what's coming and this kind of knee-jerk horror and desire to return to a simpler world, that in some ways the best way into that is precisely through the enigmatic mind of esotericism and the occult, the strange world of correspondences which suggest patterns, which point to possibilities which always remain a little bit occluded for us. That is, the minute you think you have it actually pinned down, you're probably going astray. And so I'm really happy that we can talk with Suzanne today, and she agreed to do the show. But of course, first we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Do you ever put the gap in there, or is it Daou?
I always say Daou, but certainly many people gap it up.
Gap it up. I love that. Well, I know you've been checking out some of Suzanne's work online. Was there one image that kind of really struck you, stuck in your mind?
Well, yeah, I love them. And I really like what you were saying about how she presents the kind of conspiratorial stuff without making conclusions. And, for example, the way she did the tarot deck, she's using the archetypes to kind of speak for themselves. Like, instead of saying, like, oh, this means that, and like you said, like putting an agenda on it, instead it's just a presentation of the data, of the information that's available, right? Which I think is brilliant. But, I mean, I'm a big fan of alchemical artwork, and, you know, Robert Flood seems to have influenced a lot of the work, and so I recognize almost all of the images that she's tweaked out, so it's so good. But in terms of, like, I mean, I don't know, to pick one that sticks out, they're all so good. But like I said, one of my favorites is a lot of the alchemical material. So just seeing how she laid them all out in the same kind of formats of the circles and the squares and the triangles is highly enjoyable to me.
Yeah, just one more little point, and we'll bring Suzanne on. There's another set of work she did specifically adapting alchemical diagrams, except that in the place, instead of the words of the, you know, esoteric system that whatever the alchemist was using, whether it's Flood or someone else, she just put the words on the front page of a contemporary newspaper.
Yeah, the USA Today one was super good.
It's amazing because it's the perfect expression of this sense that the ordinary news we get, the mainstream picture of reality, is actually concealing some esoteric pattern of powers and connections that you can't quite see. And if you could just put the words together right, you could squeeze this gold of meaning out of the dross of the mundane media stream, but yet it remains frustratingly elusive to process.
Totally.
So I really, really love this stuff. Anyway, we're enough praising you when you're in the room but not talking. Suzanne, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hello.
Hello, are you there?
Hi there, I'm there, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Again, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and so, you know, I realize that, I approach your work, you know, as someone very interested and invested in the themes that you're playing with. And, you know, I keep up with art, but I don't think about it so much in terms of how it fits into the art world or where it comes from in terms of artistic practice and what sort of interventions it's making in that world. I just go, oh, wow, this is the stuff that fascinates me, that works for my intellectual and esoteric interests. But what I'm really curious about, there's so much stuff that you've been, your more recent work that deals with these themes, but how, since you've, been an artist for quite a long time working in all sorts of media and traditional painting and drawing and computer graphics and installation and performance art, a wide range of media. When did your interest in this kind of esoteric meditation on power politics in the 20th century in our current world, when did that start to emerge? Were those interests that you've had since the beginning, or did they start to come up once your artistic practice was already established?
I think it's probably actually since the beginning, because in the mid-80s I was making this series of large paintings called Venus and the Revolution, and it was kind of to do with the artifacts from the Soviet Union in relation to histories of feminism, in relation to Russian folk history and power and all kinds of things. But I could never quite explain what I was doing at the time. I was pretty incoherent. But I was trying to put all these things together. What it ended up being classified by the art world was postmodernism, which it wasn't. It wasn't just appropriation. It was actually trying to make a kind of history painting, if that makes any sense. And then after that, I got interested in the idea of video games, and so I started making paintings which were imaginary video game scenarios, like stills from a video game which had some kind of political content in them, but often to do with art. Let's say I made one which was called Coons Kiefer video game, which was Jeff Koons, the kind of 80s artist, as a kind of My Little Pony going into a forest of books, which was supposed to be Anselm Kiefer, and what all that signified. So, and then pretty soon after that, I got into computers and the whole politics of the net, and so it just kind of one thing led to another, I suppose.
Well, I'd like to kind of stay on that point about postmodernism a little bit, because I think it helps sort of place your work, but also show how it's different. I think the idea is that initially you can look at your work, since you're drawing from all these different kinds of media, and you're in a sense sampling from the real world. You're taking stills from movies and handwritten scraps of paper and photographs and book. You'll draw the covers of books, and you'll sort of sample these historical streams, which has that character, that postmodern idea of, we're just appropriating, we don't have anything new to say, we're making collages of the kind of meaningless juxtapositions that constitute our lives today. But what you're doing is acting more like an esoteric thinker who recognizes that there are correspondences between things that might look superficially not familiar, and so it's really kind of more of a mode of research, of trying to actually show connections between political ideologies, technologies, popular culture figures, and really trying to actually say something, although it remains always slightly enigmatic because there's this element of the unsaid in the picture. But in terms of the questions you're asking or were asking and have come to ask, what are the real concerns for you? Are you more interested in trying to talk about the political reality of this sort of a power and our sort of construction of reality, or are you also kind of interested in some of these esoteric ways, occult ways of thinking about the world?
I guess I'm trying to bring it all together, really, in an old-fashioned kind of bringing it all together kind of way. With the Hexen 2.0 project, that's probably the most, serious attempt I've had to engage, politically, overtly, and to... I suppose what I really wanted to do was put together a really big historical picture that people, for a lot of people, they might know a bit of this or a bit of that, but I felt this absolute need to put it all together and try and make it coherent, and actually maybe it could be useful to work out a way forward for people who wanted to, think that way, and that was kind of the point of the tarot deck, to actually be able to use it like a tool to come up with new ideas. up with all those, with a lot of concepts at your disposal, a lot of history and information and ideas at your disposal within the cards and within the diagrams, and how history has produced certain situations and how all those things relate to, you know, from technology to other histories, and, you know, from ideas in science fiction, how they relate to things that have happened, and the kind of histories go back and forward. And then what, you know, with the history of cybernetics and the internet, I just wanted to somehow bring those into this one image, so it would be easier to get a grasp.
Yeah, there's something about one of the things I find inspiring about the work. It's also that you use diagrams a lot. So some of your work has these sort of immense charts, like flow charts of connections between various figures and ideas, and you'll draw circles and lines and a variety of different ways of connecting and really going into the diagram as a way of thinking. And, of course, diagrams always have these sort of magical characters to them, even if they're very trying to be very literal and very fact-minded. There's always a kind of playfulness and at the very least a sort of artistic element, but also something that reminds us of alchemical diagrams or maps of correspondences between different parts of the world, or the tree of life in the Kabbalah, things like that. And so what I walk away from is this sense that there's all of these different streams of our that are operative in our world, the history of technology, the popular culture, mind control conspiracies, overt economic arrangements, hidden histories, mainstream histories, and we're like, how do you navigate through this? And in a way, what your work encourages is kind of like, make a diagram. There's always going to be another one, you know, and in a way a tarot card is an invitation to make a diagram. The throw of the tarot cards laid out in whatever arrangement you have is like a diagram of different forces that are interacting with one another, or an astrology chart too. It's where the planets are, how are they interacting, how are they corresponding, how are they connecting. And it's like an encouragement to use these occult ways of drawing connections, but to, instead of drawing them between archetypes or ancient, pagan images or esoteric figures, instead use the material that you're surrounded by, the things that are actually operative in our world. So I'm curious, have you heard of people using the deck as sort of a oracular tool, or different things that people are doing? I know that it's been quite successful. So you must have had some interesting feedback from users, so to speak.
I have. I've had a lot of feedback, and sometimes when I've travelled to the exhibitions where I've shown it around the world, various people will come up to me and say, you know, I'm a professor from such and such a university, and I'm now using it with my class, which is brilliant. it's actually become a teaching aid in universities. So that's really exciting. And then a tarot reader from America once got in touch with me to say that she, you know, I think a lot of people in the tarot community had been a little bit suspicious of it. There was a lot of things on the internet at first, but some of them have written to say they've had a fantastic time using them and coming up with all kinds of interesting ideas that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to think of. But I was going to say, in terms of the thing that when you want to talk about the kind of occult side of things, I suppose the thing is for me is that when I was quite young, I used to read quite a lot of novels where they would be stuff to do with the Kabbalah and Gematria and things like that. So I think at quite a young age I got interested in analysing things in that way. So for example, when you do a kind of numerological reading through, let's say, the Talmud or something, where you're analysing what things might mean by converting the Hebrew letters into numbers and then making those correspondences and adding them up and making interpretations, that always seemed really, really exciting to me as another way of thinking about things, whether or not you necessarily believed in it as a kind of, you know, scientific method. That wasn't of any real interest, really. I definitely subscribe to the idea that science clearly hasn't discovered everything or the meaning of everything. I mean, that would be, you know, by default it hasn't. So therefore there's a whole load of other things and they're all worth exploring.
Well, but it's interesting, too, because it's a methodology, right? I mean, there's a scientific method that most of us use, you know, in different cultures. A lot of people use scientific method. But that's, you know, of course, if you read Karl Popper, that's got its issues, too. So what's the Kabbalistic, and especially the Gematria stuff, it gives an alternate method of, like, putting things through the machine, so to speak. So it's just this, like, processing mechanism, and it's so cool to go back to something Eric had said earlier, the fact that you can put these modern day things in there and have it still be readable. And as you've seen with your class, there's like these nerds, you know, these Kabbalah nerds or Bible nerds, and they use the Bible codes and the Gematria, and theoretically you should be able to put in anything, like whether it's you know, your family or the government or a political system or a person. Like, you should theoretically be able to plug anything into this system, even if it's something psychological, and it should still run the machine. So
Exactly. You
actually get, by using that, you're taking, like, different subject areas and then combining them, and it should still work. So the I think it's kind of, like, important evidence, really.
Yeah, it could work as much as any other experiment.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think people are recognizing that more and more. I mean, one of the things I'd love to hear you reflect on a little bit. It seems to me, from my perspective, that the art world over the last, let's say, 10 years, has become much more open to explorations of the sort of occult underbelly or the mystical fringe of artistic and technological practices. It seems like it's become more available in a perhaps somewhat ironic way, but also, you know, in a kind of a serious sense, that there are real sources of vision, of beauty, of critique, of the elements that we want out of art in this kind of esoteric, you know, underground history that, you know, has been part of the modern West since the get-go. Do you have a sense, in terms of how people are responding to your work, of more room to engage the kind of esoteric approaches within contemporary art making?
You're absolutely right. It's all been kind of, you know, building up speed, I guess, for at least the last 10 years, probably. And it's interesting because my work kind of goes from, like, the political to the occult. I've noticed that over the last few years, most of the shows I've been invited into, the group shows, they've had more of like an occult theme. And then very recently, let's say the last 2 years, they've been tended to be more shows with a more political themes. And I'm not sure whether that's because of a slight shift in my work or whether the occult thing is slightly fading off a bit and people are just getting a bit more politically engaged because of certain issues that are coming up. I'm not sure. You probably know the artist Susan Hiller, for example. She's been very influential for younger generations of artists, and she's always been very interested in those kind of phenomena, exploring them in different ways. Do you know her?
What's it say, the name?
Susan Hiller.
Oh, yeah.
American-British artist. Yeah.
And so how have people reacted, I mean, to the occult ideas in your work, especially initially? I mean, you know, even going back to the video game stuff, you were kind of referring again in a playful way to sort of mystic powers things along with the sort of political elements. Was it initially more, was there more puzzlement about your work, let's say, when you were, you know, starting the Roslyn Brodsky project, or was it, or did people always kind of get what you were doing?
I think when I started the Roslyn Brodsky project, I'd kind of left the mainstream art world behind in England, and I'd moved to Australia in 92, and that Roslyn Brodsky project started pretty much soon after that, and that was at the point where I really got into the new media art world, and so the audience were new media people, and so they obviously got it because the idea of an alter ego and the whole thing of technology. But the mainstream art world back in England actually never got it, really, I don't think. It's only recently since I've been, because I went from Australia in, like, from 2002 to Berlin in 2003. So I lived for 2 years in Berlin and only came back to London in 2007. So I've kind of been a recent re-engagement with, you know, what is the art world here. I think it's peculiar because I think because of the combination of the kind of political information that my work has, which for most people, they haven't necessarily heard of it because they're usually a little bit on the level of what's in the newspapers. And then the occult side, a lot of people tend to think I'm completely bonkers, which is really irritating. So when I hear you talking about my work, it's like, what a relief. You know, so anyone who gets it, it's like, that's such a relief. But most people, I'd say that, you know, most people just think it's some kind of crackpot thing or that it's conspiracy theory because they don't actually understand the nature of conspiracy theory or what they mean when they say conspiracy theory because they haven't thought it through. It's often quite tricky for me.
I can imagine. I'm not surprised you're saying that because, one of the reasons that I find, I'm kind of repeating myself, but find the work appealing is that there is a sort of, you don't get the sense that you exactly know that there's some master plan of all the connections that you're suggesting. That instead there's a kind of intuitive, you know, well, maybe this is part of the picture. Maybe this is part of the network of correspondences between these institutions and this film and this soundtrack and all of these things. And so it has a feel of some kind of conspiracy material in the sense that it's an imaginative act. I mean, I was just reading the cover story of this month's Fortean Times is a very creepy sort of mind control tale, a little bit more fringy than they usually have because they usually kind of walk a sort of line on this stuff. And this was a little spookier, and the author of it, which I'm actually pulling up right now, the author of the story, Robert Guffey, apparently wrote a book called Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form. And I started to think about conspiracy theory as an art form, or rather the artistic aspects of that kind of, you start off with a set of data points, a lot of them are pretty solid, then there's some that are less solid, then things start to become kind of imaginative, then they become kind of self-referential, or the knowledge that they're, you know, that some of the data sources are dubious becomes part of the construction. But people are doing it out of a sense of really trying to articulate a truth, to finding out, to sort of representing something that's true about reality, which a lot of art has left long ago. You know, it's not about trying to find truth anymore. It's about some other set of things, which is fine. It's wonderful. But yeah, in your work, you have some of that. You are trying to point directions towards truth. And that brings a really interesting kind of tension. And I'd love to hear you talk about that aspect of what you're doing, where you're really like, look, I'm not just playing. You know, there is something here that's actually really important. I mean, I agree with you. I think the stuff that the politics that you're revealing, those are the politics. If you don't know that, if you're not wrestling with that stuff, you're not really paying attention. But you know, it's still a little outsider. So.
Yeah. I've always been a bit naively idealistic, I guess, and even when I get disillusioned with the world, you know, like a week later, I'm somehow back on track again. I know. When I was 16, I decided I wanted to save the world, and then I think when I got a bit older, I realized maybe the world didn't want to be saved or changed or whatever. You know, then what else would I do? So, I just get very frustrated when people don't know a whole load of stuff, really, and I just want to, you know, and when this latest, you know, the revelations that will remain nameless have been recently emerged, the person who's trying to escape from the people who are trying to catch him, it's amazing because suddenly everyone knows what's going on with all our data, but everything just seems the same, and I think I've been screaming for ages, and like nobody listened. And now I feel like, well, maybe I'll just go on holiday.
Yeah, it's a real tough one. I wrestle with this, and I think a lot of people do all the time, where it's like I'm in two worlds, where there's the world I'm just sort of, doing my projects and making connections and, trying to earn some money and, do interesting things and help clarify things. And then, but beneath it, there's this ambient sense that I'm just sort of like this already charted statistical data point that's just producing information at every step of the way, that's being absorbed into these vast kind of archon-like cybernetic systems that have just got me already anticipated. They even know what my moves are.
Yeah, and just get fed back in some pipe and end up with Coca-Cola or something.
and it's a really, really creepy sense. But then I realize I talk to people about it, and sometimes I get these sort of quizzical looks like, man, have you been smoking pot? Or, what have you been reading? And I'm like, I'm not even talking about like actual conspiracy, like actually trying to figure out, who's really running the show and how deep does it go. And I'm not even talking about, I'm just talking about like just an everyday feeling that there's this quality of the unreal, and it's sort of disturbing, and that's injected into the world, and that's just, I find your work very inspiring, because there is a playfulness about it, even though there's some really dark implications if you start drawing the connections. There's a playfulness, and there's also a sense that, hey, we can still think about what's happening. We can still engage it and not just pretend it's not there, or try to avoid it in other ways. So I think it's very affirming in some ways, and I hope that some of the feedback you get does reflect that sense of affirmation that I find in it.
Well, hopefully it's. Yeah, I think it just depends where it is. I think the London art world, for example, is very concerned with its own bubble, and I'm not quite sure whether it's actually that interested in what anything's actually about. But I find in Germany there's a lot of people much more, and get curated in Germany, much more kind of on the ball, actually.
Yeah, well, I just actually got the catalog for the Whole Earth show. Wonderful, wonderful show. I wish I could have attended that, but I saw that your work was included there. It was a fascinating exploration of the role of the Whole Earth catalog and Stuart Brand and that phase of cybernetics in terms of our current world and information politics and the psychedelia. And, I mean, they actually didn't really go into the psychedelia dimension. That was the one side that I was disappointed by, although you cover that quite well. But yeah, it does seem that there, in Germany, there's an understanding of systems theory in a way as a cultural, political force that doesn't seem to be really true anywhere else, including the States, even though so many of the stories are here.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to take a break now. This is a wonderful conversation. It's great to be talking to you. So you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dao. We're talking with Suzanne Treister about Hexen and other artistic occult conspiracies. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dao. We're here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Suzanne Treister about alchemy, tarot, political propaganda, and conspiracy theories. We're so lucky we get to do this show, Eric. So, Suzanne, I have a question for you. And in my experience working with occult material and meeting people that, even, people that know nothing about it and, say, decide to make a tarot deck. I've had several artist friends that just decided, I want to make a tarot deck. And they really came into it pretty green. And then by the end of it, they become, the archetypes of tarot intrude upon their life. And they become a little bit taken over by it. And similarly, with a lot of the images you were using and in putting together and making these connections, you as a person, as an individual, were going through the process as well, going through the machine. And I'm curious if you had
like, did you come to some overwhelming conclusion in your work? I know this isn't, like, a very fair question, but, like, you know, a lot of people that start getting into conspiracy theories, they get swallowed up by the propaganda and the fear, but when you actually work with arranging, like, what are the facts, you can sometimes see, you know, see the picture from above, see the bird's eye view. Did you, was there any particular pattern or bird's eye view that stuck out to you the most in working with this material?
That's a good question. Can I get back to you after the next break? I'm probably going to think of something brilliant about, in about 2 hours' time. The overwhelming, well, the whole point for me was to actually see that big picture. And I suppose all I can really say is, I'm not sure whether your question is more to do with the tarot or more to do with the entire kind of historical, political situation. For the whole 3 years that I was working on this project, it was a massive relief to me in a way, because I was able to maintain, contain in my head the relationship between the history of cybernetics and all kinds of different psychological work and anthropological work and scientific work and computer research in relation to so many other things. And to have a grasp of how we got to where we are, which had always been, you know, a bit hazy for me before. Obviously, that's not the only way you can describe the world, but it is one way you can describe where we are now as, you know, human beings. And so it was exhilarating. That's all I can say. And I guess having finally got a grip on it, I wanted to quickly not get run over by a bus and publish the book and make sure everyone else could get a grip on it.
Well, it's really true, especially when, because... Yeah, and it seems like your work, which I love, by including the older models, you are source-seeking, right? You're trying to find out, like, well, what would make this happen, or what could the cause of this be, or how is this related to that? And whenever you go source-seeking on these little missions to be like, well, hey, wait a minute, this didn't just, like, appear out of nowhere. What is its nature? And when you can further, like, ascribe those to these archetypes that are timeless, that are, that cross cultures, that cross those bounds. And so you kind of did like two jobs. You were able to, like you said, like find out, like get a grip on it, like get a good knowledge of how this stuff is operating. But then on a meta level, you're able to also see, oh, well, how does this tie in to, like, you know, other bigger patterns that are repeating, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was
terribly, terribly exhausting, I can tell you, because I had this whole, I had this thing on my desk, which was a kind of a printout of, in miniature of each tarot card, and then all the interpretations, and I had these little post-it notes where on the, each post-it note was a thing or a concept or a person or a bit of history or whatever that was going to become a card. And, and then I had to keep going round and round and round to make sure that they all worked out so that they, there was one for each that matched each card. And so at the beginning it was easy, but towards the end when there was only 10 cards left to do and I had about 50 things left over and none of them fitted, you know, go round in circles and then change one, move, take one out and put something else in it. And then, yeah, get kind of get really neurotic about had I actually been absolutely 100% true to what I thought the interpretation of that card was in relation to the entire total history of that person who was going to now be that card.
Yeah, well, reality seems to always exceed the capacity of our map. So that crack is, I think, kind of inevitable, as is the anxiety. You know, I mean, when you're describing that, I'm just reminding, like, especially the first, my first book, which was kind of like that. It was sort of like this, you know, astral map of the politics of technology and media, and but it sort of drew from the archetypes. So I remember that same sense of like having to cram it all in and like find that place. And there's always this gap, and there's something that's extra, and it doesn't fit. But that's that's kind of the picture.
Yeah.
Having worked with this stuff, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the occult and the tarot and such, but I'm, from the political, historical angle, having spent time with this stuff for years now and playing with its more enigmatic and uncanny edges, have you found yourself sort of wrestling with I don't want to say, like, conspiracy thinking. It's not quite fair. I don't even know exactly how to say it. Like the politics that you're pointing to, that the story you're telling, really is pervasive and really much more structuring of our world than, let's say, the surface of the news. That there is this sort of underbelly that you're like, in some ways, implicated in to the extent that you're talking about it and you're reflecting on it publicly, and that people are responding to it. Have you had to kind of wrestle with your own sort of genies of paranoia or disturbance in the field?
I knew you were going to ask that. are you saying that have I become more paranoid since I've been making this kind of work, or has my work developed?
Yeah, I guess I should have made it. Yeah, you could say that. I was trying to be more subtle.
Yeah, that's basically what you're asking me. And I think maybe I always had a slightly paranoid character anyway, but that, I think that was always because I was always quite analytical, always wanted to know what was actually going on and not just, you know, like, block my ears. So you could say it was just I was being realistic. I think I probably went to... I was reaching a kind of bit more of a serious level of paranoia, possibly, maybe a few years ago, when I first started putting too many things together, and I just thought, I think I need to leave the planet now, you know, it's just not very nice. I think more recently, I think especially since, as I was saying, all this stuff's come out into the open, I don't feel like that at all, really. I'm just, you know, I'm quite happy planting some flowers and going to the studio and travelling through airports, and, yeah, I'm not really bothered.
But it's funny, and I guess the reason I was sort of trying to frame it in a different way is that, you know, it's such a powerful term, and people don't want to be associated with it, and they don't want to go through it because it's not very pleasant. But I found that if you work, in my experience, working on this material, you're kind of asking for it on some level, and whether or not it's just a psychological passage that you go through, or whether it's, you know, putting together certain connections intellectually and realizing the full extent of what those things might mean. But there is something on the other side. It's not like the point is not to get kind of stuck there. But I think it's also something, I'm thinking of the phrase chapel perilous, which Robert Anton Wilson talked about, where you start going down certain roads and there's going to be a place where everything is up for grabs, or everything seems sort of malevolent in its implications, or you have no ground, and there is a kind of passageway that I think people often go through when they research these materials. But there are things on the other side. In fact, partly what draws us through is making connections with other people's work and with other ways of understanding these things, bringing them back into a public discourse, a set of associations that we can all refer to, like the Macy conferences. We should all know about the Macy conferences and the origins of cybernetics. And so it helps us bring us through, so you don't just think like, oh my God, I'm putting these things all together in my own head, off here in my garret alone, that there's a, you know, a world out there. So it doesn't surprise me that you've had both moments there.
Yeah, and I think as a friend of mine in Milwaukee, if he's listening, he'll know who he is. He's been quite involved in all kinds of things at a much deeper level than I have, and he says, you know, it's just not worth them coming to get you, really, because you're not really that dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean there's far more bigger fish out there that need to be paranoid, but then they wouldn't actually be being paranoid. I mean, I think the word, the trouble with the English language, you know, it has these words like paranoid and conspiracy theory, which get kind of algae growing all over them up to the sky, and no one really stops to think what they really mean or what they mean when they're saying that. And so, I mean, because it's they're very similar words in a sense that when you say that someone's paranoid, you're implying that they are frightened of something which doesn't exist. But in fact, if they're frightened of something which does exist, you'd still call them paranoid, but you'd be incorrect.
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead, Maja.
I was just going to say that really plays into the psychology of making any of these discoveries. I mean, like Eric said, it could be like the situation where you're alone in your house for days and days on some internet thing and you find out about, you know, the lizard people or something. And you're like, oh, my God, I figured it out. I'm the one that has, like, cracked the code. There's, like that crack. That code cracker syndrome that you get where you feel like you're the only one that's done it. And so then you think, wherever you go, everyone can tell. But then you have to, people forget. They're like, oh, wait, if this exists, that means that, it's been here for, a long time. And all these people have been figuring it out. So part of it, it can have, I believe, the opposite effect of paranoia where you actually feel, enlightened by the information where it's kind of like a relief where it's like, oh, that's what that is,
Yes. And I think, I'm interested in history and politics and trying to get to the bottom of it. So, that's not frightening necessarily.
Right.
I'm just trying to help people. I shouldn't be frightened of doing that. That would be sad.
Well, and the thing is, to get fright, like I said, it's always been happening. So if you're going to get scared all of a sudden, what was the last 20 years of your life like? Why weren't you scared then? It was still happening for the last 20 years, but just because it wasn't in your consciousness, now you're going to have fear about it,
Yeah. You see, I don't know whether you've read up any of my previous interviews, but, my father was in the French Resistance, and he survived the Holocaust, came to London and worked for the Polish government. And when he was there, an old friend of his from Lwów University, he was a Polish courier called Jan Karski, he brought all these microfilms of all these images from the concentration camps and all kinds of other things, managed to get them from Poland through to the UK.
Wow.
And he brought them to my dad. And my father actually showed me these photos when I was six. So... I think I didn't have a choice,
Right, you were in it.
You see what I mean? So, So I spent my childhood listening to these stories, people always saying they went like sheep to the gas chamber, and I think I decided when I was quite little that I was going to try and stop anything like that happening again, if I possibly could, just little me, but I know it's silly. But I think that's probably... why I'm interested in all these kind of things ultimately, really.
So what would you say to people who are interested in exploring this history more, to understanding more about this sort of, more shadow side of power, control, technology, popular culture, the sort of things that you're covering, how does one get into it? Where's a good point of sort of access?
I'm not sure. There's so much stuff out there. I think that's it sounds egotistical, but I did get my Hexham 2 book because that I've actually tried to actually simplify a lot of things and make it coherent into one unit. Otherwise, you could read books about the Macy conferences, about cybernetics. You could read all the old copies of the Holocaust catalog, or you could read thousands and thousands of articles from NetTime, for example, from 1994 when it started, the discussion list. There's so much material out there. You could take your whole life.
Yeah. But it's great work, and I have one a particular historical question since I'm here in the West Coast. I very much was influenced by a lot of the psychedelic and whole earth kind of legacy in all sorts of ways, and I'm kind of curious how you have come to think of the role of that sort of hippie transformative mind tool culture in creating this much more challenging and not necessarily so liberating situation that we're in. I mean, I think that some people look at the connections between, let's say, the Holler's catalog and Stuart Brand and that kind of thinking and how it flowed into Apple computer and into the internet ideology and into the world that we live in today, and say, there was nothing positive about that at all. It was all just flim-flam. It was just a moment that was about to be recuperated into this much darker kind of machine of capitalism, unleashed capitalism and mind control, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's, you know, much more complex, nuanced stories that sort of have almost like a back and forth between these moments of sort of liberation and invention and innovation and a kind of a sort of network of control. And so I'm really curious, since you have so much of that in your tarot deck, Timothy Leary and Huxley and the Whole Earth and all of that, that stream, how have you come to see that particular current of thought and experience?
Well, I guess the first thing I could say, I suppose, is that, like the counterculture, like any scientific invention, you know, it's going to develop and be used in, you know, positive, negative ways and all the ways in between. That's kind of the nature of you know, the human history, I suppose. And, you know, it's like, and like, let's say, in the Macy conferences, some of the scientists there were, you know, really in with the military, and some of them were really pacifists, and some of them were more interested in developing control societies, and, for example, and other ones are more interested in going back and playing with their turtles. So it's obviously everything's very various, but I think in terms of the way that the way the project developed, it became clear that out of the five diagrams, one of them had to be an explanation of how the counterculture interrelated with all those other aspects of that history. So the way it related to the CIA and the LSD testing, and then onto Stuart Brand's kind of Whole Earth Catalogue, been seen as a precursor to the World Wide Web and his embracing of technologies, and then some of the counterculture that went away from that into more anarcho-primitivist directions and rejected technology. So, because in a sense, the Hexham 2 project was a kind of, apart from the fact that I wanted to try and sort something out, it was a kind of discussion between, pro and anti-technology, in a sense. And I think that was one thing I was trying to work out, because I feel very uncomfortable with the way technology is changing the planet and us. But I don't like to feel like I'm a reactionary. So at the same time, I don't want to turn the clock back and go back to Paleolithic times. So I personally can't see any solution to any of it which is going to work. And that's another thing I was trying to do. And so that's a roundabout way of saying how the counterculture came in kind of one of the centers of it, I suppose.
No, but that was a very beautiful... That was just a very beautiful statement, just because I felt like I've gone through very similar processes myself, and I have come to a certain space of sort of absolute befuddlement about, you know, what to do, and I think that's again one of the affirmative dimensions of your work, is that it's not linked to a particular agenda, and so it's kind of scary on the one hand, or disturbing, but on the other hand, it's like, well, here we are, you know, it's been a fascinating history, it's a lot of things going on, don't think there's an easy way out. But I'm sorry I interrupted you, Maja.
Well, no, like that. I mean, I feel like a lot of your work is also trying to identify, like, what is this role that technology is having? Like, what is it? Where does it fit? You know, is it bad? Is it good? What is the implication of it? And I feel like through your iterations of, like, trying to affiliate it, like, what does it correspond to? Is it like this? Is it like that? Really, a lot of your work is trying to put a pin on identifying, like, the nature of that energy, you know, which I feel like nobody else really is doing.
Right. Yeah.
So we just got a few minutes left here. I'm curious what you're working on now.
I'm actually working on a secret project to transform the city of Bordeaux. But I'm not allowed to talk about it.
No, good. I'm glad you have your own black ops shenanigans to set up. That's great. You should at least let us know when we should go to Bordeaux so that we can find out the results.
Well, apparently this project could go on until 2030. I may be dead by then.
Oh, that's wonderful. Any of your events coming to the United States anytime soon?
Actually, yeah. Hexant is coming to Cleveland Institute of Art Gallery in November. I think the opening is on the 8th of November. Cleveland, Ohio. I have been doing some other new work apart from this secret infiltration of Bordeaux, which I'm going to be having a show on the 31st of October in London and Le Jus de Fine Art with probably all the work I've done over the past 3 years that wasn't Hexant 2.0. Some stuff to do with algorithms and some other stuff to do with particular documents that we mentioned earlier and a whole range of things.
That's great. And will you do another book, you think? That was one thing I wanted to ask you. Is it seems to me from talking to you and also looking at the books that, you know, a lot of artist books, they're like artist books. And they go in your, like, artist bookshelf. And they're sort of like they're kind of fancy. And they have, like,
drawing.
Intelligent commentary. And they're sort of high-toned. And I love art books, so I have lots of those. But your book shows up, it's like kind of an unusual publisher, it's inexpensive, it's more accessible, it's kind of, you know, it almost seems like you were very conscious of making your books that people could read, books that people could access, books that people who aren't into art books might come across.
You're right, yeah, you're right. And in fact, some people, I think, who see my work, they don't actually know it's art. I'll get emails from people who'll say, I just saw this thing on your website. What is it? They don't realize it's supposed to be art. They think it's something kind of unnameable. And then likewise with the books, you know, because of Black Dog Publishing, they distribute all over the place. They're not just an art publisher. So it gets into all kinds of shops here and there. And I guess, you know, really my ideal target audience is like 15-year-olds whose brains are just beginning to kind of absorb all kinds of other stuff that their parents didn't tell them.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's so true. I mean, it's like Black Dog. They also, like, I think I had an essay in a book they had on krautrock, you know. So it's there's a rock and roll side, a kind of you know, and they did another collection on black metal music. So it's a really perfect place, and I think that's actually a laudable goal as well. Like, there should be more work that's being done for that, you know, 15-year-old mind that's just ready to, like, find a new map and go crazy with it. It's wonderful as a, you know, no longer 15-year-old mind to see that stuff again, because it reminds me of that kind of energy and that kind of fascination and what drew me into thinking about these things really early on for me. I was that age when I got into this stuff, or even younger. There is a continuity there that I really like, and that's part of what's wonderful about your work. It's not just about how fragmented and overwhelming our moment is now. There's also the sense of continuity, of back through the past, that there's a reason to study history. There's a reason to look at the history of occultism and esotericism as well as the history of science. And so, you know, keep up the good work. I think we got to wrap it up there. I just want to let people know that they can check out Suzanne's stuff on her website, SuzanneTreister.net, and there's another website devoted to Hexant 2.0, and you can get a lot of the information looking online, even if you don't get one of the great books. So Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
Great. Well, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.